Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guests are Tamarind Norwood. I nearly said Tamarind. I'm sorry. It was Tamarind Norwood. And Nico Oliveira. Nico is of the SE8 Gallery. Tamarind Norwood is an artist and writer. Recent UK commissions include Tate Britain, Art on the Underground, Modern Art Oxford, and the London Word Festival. She is now completing a practice-led doctorate in fine art as an Oxford University Clarendon Scholar. Is that correct, or is this out of date?
No, that's right.
Okay. So welcome to you both. We're here ostensibly for the on the occasion of your exhibition, Tamarind, at the SE8 Gallery and the launch of a new record.
Yes, which is happening tomorrow. Between 4 and 6 in the afternoon as part of the ArtLix Festival. And we're very excited to be launching another record. And we shall be hearing, I think, later on a little bit of this record, as well as several other pieces that Tamarind has been making. And the show itself is open usually 2 days a week, although this weekend we're opening for 3 days a week. Between 12 and 6 in the afternoon. And the feedback has been very, very positive so far. It's also part of the Detford X Festival at the moment. So Detford at the moment is filled with art-loving revelers, which is always quite nice. And it's unusual to see so many people who express so much of an interest in what is, after all, cutting-edge art. And at times, slow art that takes a little time to get into.
Mm-hmm. Is that a theme of this event? Is it supposed to be slow?
No, I think this is something that's at SE8, perhaps that's a groove that we have mined for a little while, in that we only make projects as and when they are relevant, and that comes about through discussion with different artists. And we're fortunate to have Tamarind working very closely with us, because this was a show that's been developed over the last year or so, and it finally opened. So as a result, the space is rather fragmented. There are pieces that are difficult to view. There are also, I have to say, some pieces that are unashamedly beautiful, which is always something that delights me greatly. In other words, something that has a great deal of content and yet at the same time is difficult yet very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what is the title of this show, Tamarind?
The show is called What the Point Is, The End of the Line.
Right, okay. So is that a metaphor for something? Is it what's it the end of?
Well, what I'm really interested in is the point of contact between the pencil and the page, what the point is. When I think about the point, I think about that point of contact. But of course, when you think about lines, the end of the line is this point. If you imagine turning a point end on, you'd see a line end on, you'd see a point. So I'm really interested in those kinds of word plays and those kinds of visual plays, and seeing what we can kind of mine out of the relationship between the line and the point.
Is this an ongoing theme? How long has this been?
It is very much, yeah. I've been interested in this dot, this point of contact between the pen and the page, for many years now. And I've been making videos and sculptural assemblages and drawings and doing lots of writing all around this dot, this point. And actually, it's become the subject of my current PhD as well.
Okay.
So I'm getting quite.
Did you start as a writer or a visual artist?
A visual artist. A visual artist, and I've come to find that a lot of the work I make is lends itself as much to writing and creating worlds through text that perhaps you couldn't make physically or visually as much as. And then there are some things that can be explored more readily, more in a more interesting way by making objects and images.
Right. So, but is it writing as art, or is it somewhere in between writing?
I don't know. It's in between. Okay. There's the phrase art writing, which people love to use, and I think that's a really difficult phrase, but I suppose quite useful, because maybe it's quite a difficult area to know where we are in. But I mean, I work as an artist, and some of the works I make are written, and they go into, you know, publications and places where you find writing rather than places where you find visual art.
Right.
So, yeah, you could call it art writing. It's kind of prose, creative prose, and sometimes poetry.
But did you,
more that than criticism.
You started as a visual artist?
I did,
and then
yeah.
What moved into text? I mean, why? Were you inspired by text?
Do you know what? Before I started working on art, I did a degree in linguistics and medieval Italian literature, strangely. But the linguistics has really stayed with me. And I think what interests me, I think as an artist, I explore language and the kind of underlying structures of language and the kind of processes of writing and the way grammatical connections between things. So I suppose maybe before art, I was very interested. I was more interested in language, and then I found that a way to really explore language in ways that would interested me were through visual art. And then from that, I found, well, look, I think I can explore some of this through writing as well. So maybe the writing and the language have a connection there.
Yeah. So is there anything to do with the end of writing?
That's not for me. That's not really a reference point for me. But
okay.
I don't know.
I mean, there may be a way of addressing this idea of the end of writing, because I don't necessarily think it's the end of writing. Rather, in the visual arts, what has happened is that writing, like so many other new media, has been added to the roster of media. So therefore, today artists write as if maybe a long time ago they might have, you know, painted or made sculpture. And certainly we live in a time when all these different media are actually blended together.
I was trying to think about that. But there is writing as a visual art, isn't there? I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think of examples. I mean, Cy Twombly, I suppose, uses words in his paintings. There's lots of examples. I mean, Jasper Johns, I suppose lots
Fiona
of people
Banner,
have.
Tracy Emin.
Right. But that is another way to create something visual. So it doesn't lean towards the literary or the text-based work, is yours closer to that, or
I think what happens a lot in my work is that it's influenced by some of the structures of language and some of the ways that language works. And I think perhaps because I spent a long time studying linguistics and studying grammar and studying the kind of the cognitive ways that our minds create grammar and things that perhaps aren't visible on the surface of language. So I'm not necessarily thinking about the way words look on a page, but maybe the way the auxiliary and the sort of modal verb, main verbs are connected together, the way that a passive construction is made, the way that analogies can be made in language. So there's kind of more abstract qualities of language that maybe don't even relate to text on a page, but just the way that, you know, grammar and language is structured and the way translation can happen and these kinds of things. So I'm not sure. There are many artists that create text that make things that look like language on a canvas or in a visual art way. But I think for me the interest is really some of the way language works, the way you can make analogies in language. Maybe you can make similar analogies in visual art, or the way that, you know, these things are connected up.
Yeah, I noticed that I was looking through some of your interviews, and there's one piece where you talk about homophones. Which I had to sort of look up. I wasn't sure what that meant, but it's words that can sound or mean two or three different things.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you give an example of that?
Oh, off the top of my head, there and there,
right.
Wave and wave. Well, I suppose wave and wave is spelt the same way.
So that suggests ambiguity then.
Puns, yeah.
Right. And is that a consideration for you? I mean, the sort of ambiguity?
Very much, yeah. I think, in fact, the title of the exhibition, What the Point Is, The End of the Line,
itself has a double edged
Yeah, that's right.
That.
Yeah. So, I mean, what the point is, we can, you know, what's the point of this? You know, what the point is, as in the nub, the reason, which is also kind of the central point of something. And there we're using the word point, you know, in more of a kind of, topological way. And then the end of the line can refer to the end of something happening, you know, death or the end of...
Well, that's what made me think of the end of writing, because it also sounds like something is finished. And that led us to... I brought this book with me, Uncreative Writing by Kenneth Goldsmith, which prompted a sort of response with you, Nico. You sort of recognised it immediately from across the room.
Completely.
I think it seems to be relevant.
I think it's the visual literacy of the spines of books. They kind of resonate in an odd sort of way. But I guess the reason why someone like Oliver Goldsmith has been, Kenneth Goldsmith, yeah. has become very interesting and much talked about in the visual arts is precisely because of the curatorial aspect he actually places upon language, whereby effectively he argues that there is no need for further new writing. Instead, what should happen is that writing should be inserted into other situations, into other positions where it has not been before. And one of the key examples that artists are always picking up on is, in that case, let us insert existing text, in the sense of a ready-made, perhaps even, into the ambit of the art gallery or the museum. So for this reason, Goldsmith has been very much part of exhibitions. I mean, notably, he was part of an exhibition that took place at the Whitechapel Gallery some 2 years ago, where he was invited to select videos and such. So, in a sense, there's the kind of blending between a visual language and the language of the institution.
All right. Shall we play a track? You've brought along six tracks.
That's right, yeah.
Including this 7-inch vinyl.
That's right.
It's a single being released at SE8. What's the first track we're going to play?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about it, actually. I think this exhibition is very much a drawing exhibition, an exhibition of works on paper, except lots of the works are actually not drawings. Most of the works are sculptural assemblages, videos, things like that. They're not drawings, but they're about drawing. And one of the things that really interests me about drawing is blind drawing, the idea that you might be able to try to make contact with the thing you're drawing by making contact with the page. You know, you can't touch the thing you're drawing, but you can touch the page with the pencil. And if you close your eyes and handle the thing you're trying to draw and handle the pencil and move it about the page, we get somewhere very interesting, because it's as though we're actually sort of caressing the object through the pencil. Anyway, I'm very interested in all the space around drawing, and what I've chosen as our first track is an extract from, it's about a minute long, John M. Hull, who's a blind theologian, and he's written in really interesting ways about his experience of going blind. I just want to play a little extract, him describing the way he experiences space. So we'll play that.
Okay. So this is called Notes on Blindness, yeah?
Rain brings out the contours of what's around you, in that it introduces a continuous blanket of differentiated and specialized sound, uninterrupted, which fills the whole of the audible environment. If only there could be something equivalent to rain falling inside, then the whole of a room would take on shape and dimension.
Okay, so that's a blind theologian.
That's right, yeah.
And did you know him?
No, I didn't know him, no. I've been reading a book of his, and he took a lot of his notes. Well, being blind, he recorded his notes onto tape recorders, and he has these many tape recorders. And this is actually a film being created using the original audio files from his notebooks. And I find his perspective really, really interesting, because he gradually went blind over the course of 32 years or so. And he's very articulate in his experience of the change between being a sighted person and being a blind person. And in that little extract there, he's describing how when it rains, suddenly it's as though he has depth of vision. He can not only see what he can, well, you know, he He doesn't navigate just by touch. He can navigate, he can effectively see because he can see the shapes, he can hear the shapes of all his whole environment around him. Mm-hmm. And it really struck me because it means it suddenly gives his experience of his environment depth, you know.
When were these done, these recordings?
Well, they were done over I mean, he's alive today, you know. I don't know whether he's still doing them, but these were done, I think, through the 70s through to now. I'm not sure the dates.
So he recorded these texts onto a tape recorder.
Yeah, I think they were spontaneously. Okay. This was him kind of composing the text.
And how does this relate to these? Where does the drawing come into this? Because you said something about a blind theologian. People drawing blind, as it were, somebody drawing blind.
This is something I spend a lot of my time doing, drawing blind. Really? I find it really interesting. When you go to a life drawing class, it feels like your job is to try to kind of create an apparatus of imaginary sight lines between you, your eyes, your pencil, the piece of paper, and the model you're trying to draw. Hmm. And you end up with this quite kind of complicated apparatus of imaginary lines in the air, trying to measure things and get the lengths and distances right. And for me, it can feel very, you end up feeling very, very distant from the thing you're trying to draw because you've got all these lines and measurements in the way. Mm. I feel there's a relation there between the way John Hull's talking about blindness, because the minute you start drawing blind, which is to say you handle the object that you're drawing. So, you know, rather you have your, you can wear a blindfold, close your eyes.
I was going to ask you, how do you do this? Do you wear a blindfold or you just turn all the lights off?
Well, I've never worn a blindfold, but I've turned the lights off, or sometimes I just close my eyes. Sometimes, though, I just look at I only look at the object I'm drawing and don't look at the page, which creates an interesting effect as well. And actually, when you're doing that sort of half-blind drawing, looking at the model, say if it's a life drawing class, and moving your pencil around the page, it's quite an extraordinary experience because you can't see what your pencil's doing. You can't care about what the lines end up looking like because you can't see it.
Are you intending to make an accurate reproduction of what it is you're holding, or do you not care anymore? You've gone off at a tangent.
Yeah, you have to not care. I mean, it's interesting because you kind of have to not care, but at the same time, well, I feel like there's always a sort of you kind of want what you make to look good, but really you have to not care. And what you can try to do though is kind of invent strategies for trying to create a resemblance. So you move your pencil around the page and try to feel where you are on the page by using the rest of your hand, or by just memorizing where your pencil must be in the relation to where it started off. And so you can create all these strategies to help the resemblance end up looking like what you looked like. But really, you have very little control over it. Mm. Now, when all these strategies you can invent, you know, maybe you can put a bit of blue tack on the page and a bit of blue tack on the thing you're handling if you're handling something, and try to kind of line up the two bits of blue tack so you keep coming back to the blue tack with your pencil. Or you can, I don't know, use time and try to move your hands symmetrically so that one hand is handling the object and the other hand is moving around the page in a way that matches up, so you end up with a resemblance. But all of these strategies made me think of John Hull's image of rain falling inside, suddenly giving invisible surfaces reality, suddenly making things that are invisible to you, that are unreachable to you, suddenly become visible, you know. And so that's the connection I see. And I think this idea of drawing blind and groping around the page, you know, drawing is seen as something that creates, you know, that helps one see, that it is an ocular thing to do, you know, you're using your eyes and you're seeing, you're making something that becomes visual. The idea of doing it blind, I find a really interesting kind of, you know, groping, moving around, not knowing where you're going. Mm.
Mm. Nico, anything to...
I do actually have something to add at this point, which is to do with pointing. And I think one of the analogies that's come up with Tamarin is something that's... that we've talked about in relation to sound. For example, a blind person tapping the side of the road or a pavement.
Oh, yes, there was reference
with
that.
With their cane. Mm. And in a sense, it's a way of making sound on the one hand, and through sound, making a map of a territory. And I think we always try and find ways of extending the body. As we were speaking, you'll have noticed, and of course, it's fairly obvious this is radio, and we will have noticed sitting here that Tamarin actually has a way of speaking with her hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if she were drawing certain ideas in the air.
Right.
And she's always pointing at things. And in fact, there's a very nice set of photographs that my my co-curator, Nikki Oxley, actually made. There are hundreds of photographs of Tamarin's hands and gestures and so on and so forth. And these are all really relevant as a way of trying to point towards representation, trying to make space, the kind of space of the individual, but more so a space for other individuals to react to and to deal with. And often artists do this, as the great art historian Baxendall said, by pointing with a very weak finger. Pointing, in other words, is not a precise science. It's fairly random, and yet we do it, but it's incredibly powerful simply to say, it's that away.
Right. Okay. Mm. Anything to...
I was really conscious, actually, that I was gesticulating a lot when I was I was really miming for you, wasn't I? How to draw blind. And I thought, this is being broadcast with only the sound. I must stop using my hands.
That's all right.
So I put, well, because I worried that maybe what I'm saying doesn't make sense without the gesticulations. So I put my hands down, and then it was harder for me to talk. So I think you're absolutely right, Nico. I think pointing and gesticulating, maybe we're all, you know, using words as kind of imprecise pointers towards things. Mm.
Do you think that actually language is imprecise, therefore, and you're trying to sort of somehow make up for that lacking?
I wonder. I would like to say it's not imprecise. I'd like to say it was a fine instrument, but I think you're right. I think it is. And I think perhaps when one is trying to describe visual things, try to describe ideas, things that aren't immediately on the level of discourse, on the level of words, you know, maybe there's an inclination to use words, but also throw in other markers, use hands, use sketches. I think it's really interesting when people have a pen in their hand and they're kind of scribbling on the page while they talk.
Mm-hmm.
And you can then look at the scribbles at the end of the conversation and try to remember what on earth that little curve, that dot, that you know, those scratches meant.
Yeah.
So maybe,
We should we move on to the next track?
Yes.
We've got about six or seven tracks, which we're going to... The next one seems to be called The Metaphor of the Eye.
That's right, yeah. This is...
I hope I can get this one started on time.
Shall I tell you a little about it before we play?
Yes, please.
Think about groping, moving gropingly forwards. I think that's quite, you know, as you do when you're drawing blind, that's quite a nice way to look at the way one might make artwork in a studio. Grope, move forward without necessarily knowing where you're going, without an aerial perspective, but just being able to see the current, where the point of the pencil is right now, where your attention is right now, looking down at the desk, looking down at the studio floor, rather than with a big master plan, a big aerial perspective.
Yeah.
So I think this groping is quite a way of thinking about the way one works in the studio. But I think there's one way I kind of grope along in the studio is by making chains of analogies, making metaphors, but then making those metaphors cross over into each other, cross contaminate. What I'm going to play you is an extract from an essay that Roland Barthes wrote on Bataille's story of the eye. And he describes the way that Bataille creates lots of metaphors and sets up these metaphors into chains and then sets about crossing these metaphors over each other, crossing these chains over each other to create new ideas. So let's play that, then we can maybe talk about it.
Metaphorical composition. In it, a term, the eye, is varied through a certain number of substitute objects standing in strict relationship to it. They're similar, since they're all globular, and at the same time dissimilar, since they're all called something different. This double property is the necessary and sufficient condition of every paradigm. The eye's substitutes are declined in every sense of the term, recited like flexional forms of the one word, revealed like states of the one identity, offered like propositions, none of which can hold more meaning than the other, filled out like successive moments in the one story. This is the primary metaphor of the poem, but it's not the only one. A second chain springs from it, made up of all the avatars of liquid, an image equally linked with the eye, egg, and balls. Nor is it simply the liquid itself that varies, tears, milk in the cat's saucer eye, the yolk of a soft-boiled egg, sperm or urine. It is, as it were, the manner of appearance of moisture. The metaphor here is much richer than in the case of the globular. From damp to streaming, all the varieties of making wet complement the original metaphor of the globe. Objects apparently quite remote from the eye are thus caught up in the chain of metaphor, such as the bowels of the gold horse spilling like a cataract from its side. In fact, the power of the metaphor being infinite, the presence of only one of the two chains makes it possible to summon up the other. Is there anything more dry than the sun? Yet, in the field of metaphor traced by Bataille, almost in the manner of a haruspect, the sun need only become a disk and then a globe for its light to flow like a liquid and join up via the idea of a soft luminosity or a urinary liquefaction of the sky with the eye, egg and testicle theme. So here we have two metaphorical series, or, if you like, in line with the definition of metaphor, two chains of significance. Story of the eye, however, is very much more than a narrative, even a thematic one. This is because Bataille, having established the double metaphor, introduces a fresh technique. He interchanges the two chains. A term from the first chain can be coupled with a term from the second. Syntagma is immediately possible. There is no resistance at the level of common sense. Indeed, everything works towards a discourse to the effect that the eye weeps, the broken egg runs out, or light, the sun, pours down.
So that's you reading a text by Barthes about Bataille.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a bit of a chain there. Yes. Yeah, I couldn't find a recording, so I just read it out myself, I'm afraid.
Right, okay.
I find it really interesting how productive it can be when you take two things and cross them together. When you take an eyeball and treat it like an egg, when you take an egg and treat it like an eyeball. Mm. The idea of breaking an eye in the way that one could break an egg creates all kinds of incredible images about, you know, what would happen if you were to crack an eye, and you know,
it immediately puts me in mind of Enchiana and the Loup, of course,
very much.
The Buñuel film.
Absolutely.
where the eye is cut with a razor blade. But yeah, that's a fairly obvious connection.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. And I think this is the power of kind of poetic analogies, really, isn't it? You can put two images together and you end up with something entirely new.
Yeah.
And the reason I wanted to include that text is because it emerged for me as a really nice description of an aspect of this blind groping we were talking about, this moving forward in the studio, creating artworks without an aerial perspective, without a big plan, but just kind of responding work by work to the sort of physical properties of the things you're making as you go along.
Mm. I get the impression that there are things you are definitely avoiding with this process. It's like you can see that it's going one way and you think, no, I don't want it to go there. In one of the interviews, there's some reference to a wire. There's a work you did with wire.
Mm, yeah.
But you don't want it to represent something.
That's right.
You
yeah.
avoided that. And strangely, it put me in mind of an exhibition that you had, Nico, once. Was it the Museum of Installation, mm-hmm. with a Belgian artist who made shadows of wires, which he, do you remember that? I think he had candles with wires, and it cast a shadow of the wire on the wall, which made a shape.
Yes. His name was Fred Edekins. This was many years ago.
Yeah.
And in fact,
I haven't heard or seen anything of him since.
We saw his work again. It was, in fact, this year at the Brussels Art Fair, and we managed to track down his dealer. And in fact, he's still making works with wire and also with larger shadows.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
It's hard to describe. They were on the floor, weren't they? You'd have a candle, and then he would bend the wire in such a way that only the shadow made sense.
Yes.
Not the wire itself.
And you had to look at it from a very particular perspective.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I think you had a kind of spectrum whereby you could come at it from a certain angle, move about a little bit, but then very quickly would come the point at which the word would become indistinct. At which point...
Was it words?
They were all words.
Ah, okay.
And
So this is kind of the opposite of what you want to do. They were interesting, very memorable. I mean, yeah. I thought it must be at least 15 years ago. And it's the only time I've ever seen his work. But it reminded me of your, but you're sort of doing the opposite. You don't want it to represent anything.
I'm really interested in that. That's representing is one thing that you can do with drawing and writing. But then you can also, and with wire, you can sculpt visible things, recognisable things out of wire.
So do you deny the representation then? You don't want it to look. You want it to remain in this sort of problematic area.
Yeah, I'm inclined
where it hasn't
to,
evolved or something.
Where it's what it is is a residue of the act of doing it. Really, the piece of work with wire you're describing was called "Doing Words with Things," which of course plays on J.L. Austin's "Doing Things with Words." And I made that for the London Word Festival, and it was later restaged at Tate Britain, and actually I worked with two deaf poets and a deaf actor to create that, because I was the deaf contributors were signing descriptions and sometimes instructions of hand gestures. I'm gesticulating again as I'm speaking, and what I was doing was carrying out their instructions or creating things that they described out of wire. The effect was that our hands, my hands and their hands, were quite symmetrical to each other because they were describing what I was doing. But at that level of physical detail, you use a lot of onomatopoeia in sign language. And of course, what that means is effectively kind of mime-like gestures. So they would be describing me bending a wire, and it would look like they were bending a wire, you see. So my hands and their hands were kind of symmetrical. They were kind of mirror images of one another to some extent. Now, if my hands and their hands are kind of describing each other, then what I want is for my hands to create out of wire just the kind of consequences of my hand movements. Their hands are moving, my hands are moving. I don't want to then make some kind of third thing. I don't want to make something that then stands separately, because then we've got three things, my hands, their hands, and a third thing.
Is there any degree of therapy for the people involved or not? Is that completely, nothing to do with
it? I think that's nothing to do with it at all.
Okay.
Nothing to do with it at all. The BSL poets have fantastic practices as poets, and they create poems that are incredible crosses between obviously sign language has a very visual element, and they're very much kind of crosses between performances and poems, with wonderful puns in their own right. In the way that we play on words, the sounds of words in sign language, you can play on hand shapes and the recurring hand shapes and sounds like that, which create really interesting, sometimes really funny puns and things. So I think it's about this third thing. I'm interested in where I don't use representation. It's because I'm interested in the movements that have made the lines, the movements that have made the drawing, the movements that have made the writing.
Right. All right.
You see, and so if you're blind drawing, you have to not care about what's coming up, what's turning up on the page, because really what you're doing is going through a process of creating a drawing. And what ends up on the page is almost kind of a residue, a residue of that process, rather than something it represents. Okay. In fact, if it represents, it represents the process, which maybe isn't representation.
Right. Okay. I think we should move on to the next track, which is entitled Sonata. Do you want to introduce this? Or do you want to? Are we going to move
on to? Well, I think because time is running slim, should we move on to the next one?
Perhaps we should.
Yeah,
we could always come back to Sonata.
Indeed, we can.
So this next one is drawing round things.
And I really like the way you read that out, because it made me.
Well, I faltered.
Sure.
I had to stop. I had to suddenly think: does it mean drawing around things, or is it drawing round things? I think there's probably a third.
Your gesticulations are adding to this.
Right,
exactly.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I like to describe it with brackets. Sometimes side A is me drawing round things. Side B is me drawing round things. But the grammar, the underlying grammar of that is side A, I'm drawing round the circumferences of things. Side B, I'm drawing pictures of things that are round. In each case, it's drawing round things. I really enjoy those puns.
And
which is best?
Which is best? So we'll play. What we'll do is we'll play that, but actually we'll play a little bit, and then we'll talk over it, because it's 6 minutes long.
Oh, right.
So we'll play a little bit on its own, and then
okay.
So this is the sound of me drawing around things.
Should we talk over this? Shall we just leave it?
We'll leave a little
bit. I'll leave our sound up so you will be able to hear the voices as well.
So to tell you a little bit about it, maybe we can come in and out and talking. I collected up all the things in the exhibition that were round. There are quite a lot of them. Pens, the ends of glass tubes, funnels, circles cut into circles cut into bits of cardboard, all kinds of little things that are round. A desk fan. And I drew around them. The reason I wanted to do this was because I knew it was going to end up on a vinyl record. And I'm really, you know, talking about these analogies, making analogies, and Bart writing about Bataille's chains of analogies and crossing them over. If I'm fascinated by this point of contact between the pencil on the page, what might happen if I translate some of the ideas about the pencil and the page to the needle and the record? So if the pencil's moving around the page in a circular way, and that's being played by a needle that is moving around the record in a circular way, then we have a really interesting correspondence for us, not least because, of course, the needle doesn't move, the record moves. So already the correspondence is interrupted and kind of rearranged a little bit. This sound is meant to be, it's a limited edition record, and really it can only be experienced looking at the record, because then you have to closely watch the needle in the way that one would watch the pencil, you see.
The groove on the record is not regular, I presume. It's not like an ordinary...
No, it is. It looks exactly
like... So it looks just like an ordinary vinyl.
It does. I think that's the only way it would work on an
And it's a recording of the sound of a pencil going around, but not... Is that also going in a regular spiral?
This is the nice thing, because they're different, because what you're hearing now is a series of circumferences, one after the other. They start and then stop. Uh-huh. So this might be now the sound of me drawing around the top of a funnel.
Okay. And I have to say, well, what kind of materials are you using? Is it pencil and paper?
This is pencil and paper, yeah.
Any particular pencil? Hard?
Oh, it was a hard pencil. Hard pencil.
And sounds hard.
Yeah. It was a hard pencil. I experimented quite a bit with different grains of paper as well. Uh-huh. And I had to get the correspondence between the pencil, the paper and the sound recording right, because, of course, you want the right level of... You want to get a sense of what it sounded like.
So the stylus on the record becomes a sort of substitute for the point of the pencil on the paper.
Exactly.
So you're looking at the stylus whilst the record is playing, and but the sound you're getting is of a pencil and paper. So is there an intention to this other than it being a sort of material thing? Are you looking for a gap between these two?
It is the gap I'm really interested in. Yeah. I really like the way that one can watch the... If that track stopped, you can play the next one, because then it's side B.
Yeah. The
way that the needle, the very regular movement that the record and the needle are making together, this very regular spiral, is describing very irregular circles, repeated very irregular circles going round and round and round. And if you try to imagine that that's the movement the needle is making, it ends up as some kind of a spirograph, going round and round and round and sort of pivoting off itself again and again and again, creating a kind of irregularity where there was regularity.
Right.
And I just really enjoy that, the discord. You know, they're not doing the same thing, but they're nearly doing the same thing, which makes it quite an engrossing thing to watch. And then on the back... You have on side B, you have the sound of me drawing pictures, which is what we're listening to now, pictures of the round things.
Yeah.
So here, if you imagine the correspondence between the needle and the record, and the pencil is going all over the place, to and fro, sharp lines, straight lines, everything.
It's interesting because it's just occurred to me that, I mean, a lot of artists' records use vinyl just because it's a sort of... In this case, it's not arbitrary. There is a complete... It couldn't be done any other way.
You couldn't do it on
a CD or a cassette tape or a reel-to-reel. It is specifically about the process of the record.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's really important, that it's... in the way that I'm very interested in the materiality of the pencil.
Right.
Likewise, the materiality of the record and the needle. Yeah.
There was indeed a discussion at one stage, simply because of the run-on times of vinyl, which have gone completely crazy at the moment, because essentially what happened was that all these factories a decade ago or two were shut down, leaving very, very few to suddenly cope with the increased demand by musicians, of course, but also visual artists who continue to want to mine this particular medium.
Yeah.
So vinyl has had a massive resurgence, and as a result, there are enormous backlogs of actually trying to get vinyl manufactured, because the only factories that are still really producing large volume are in the Czech Republic, and they can't cope. So in fact, at one stage, we were indeed talking about making a CD, but indeed, as we've just heard, Tamarin said very clearly that would not function, because it would be a completely different piece.
Exactly.
In fact, it would be a non-piece.
Unless we were interested in what the laser does on the, you know,
that would be a different process, wouldn't it? This is like, I suppose, like a sculpture in a way.
I think it is.
The record becomes
a
sort of sculptural object, doesn't it?
Yes.
Sound sculpture, I suppose.
It needs to be seen up close.
So what's the edition size of this record?
It's 30, isn't it?
Only 30? Oh, my gosh, that's a small...
Only 30. Usually we make a much larger edition. These are 30 hand-signed and numbered examples, and there ain't going to be no more.
How much does it cost, this piece?
50.
Right. Okay. You should have brought one with you. We didn't have one, did we? We could have played it and watched and actually gone through the... Because this is playing from a USB, but had we had one on the turntable, we could have...
We have an empty cover with us, which is the closest we can get to it.
Okay.
And we are launching it tomorrow from 4 to 6.
And do you know what? That's going to be the first time I've ever seen it working, so I'm very excited.
Oh, really?
Because I did the drawing and I've heard the MP3 because I've prepared it.
Yeah.
But I've never seen the record actually playing, so I've never seen the work in real. So
any
I'm
particular turntable? Do you have a choice of turntable? Or is that irrelevant? You don't care?
No. We actually have a very nice system, which we bought some time ago. It's a very nice, some 15-year-old NAD system, which...
Right.
Was sold to us as part of an exhibition, and we love it dearly. So, yes, that's where it will be tomorrow.
Okay. So, you better, I don't think you've said where your gallery is, have you yet?
It's 171 Deptford High Street,
right,
just around the corner from the train station.
Yeah.
So, we are on the high street itself.
And it's called SE8 Gallery?
SE8 Gallery, which simply stands for the postcode. It's very simple.
Yeah. Okay, so we are. This is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guests are Tamarin Norwood and Nico Oliveira of the SE8 Gallery on the event of your exhibition. Please remind me the title of the exhibition again.
It's called What the Point Is, The End of the Line.
Thank you. So where should we move on now? What should we do?
Well, very helpfully, you referred to the record piece as drawing round things as a kind of audio sculpture,
really.
And what's nice is that's just how I think of this piece we're going to listen to now, which is Henri Chopin and Rouge. It's part of his audio poem series.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say much about it before we play it, but just it's incredible how visual it is for me, and perhaps we can help we can use it to help us think more about representation, how language represents or doesn't represent.
Rouge, rouge, rouge. Choc, dur et rouge. Rouge. Bruit. Rouge. Choc. Rouge. Nu. Rouge. Rouge, nu. Il est que veine, il est que sang. Il est que chair. rouge, 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 rouge.
Il n'est que veine, il n'est que veine, il n'est que veine, il n'est que sang, il n'est que sang, il n'est que chair. Rouge, 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 rouge,
Rouge by Henri Chopin, the noted French sound poet. Do you have an affinity with concrete poetry and sound poetry? I mean, is that something that you've got involved with or
studied? I have studied got or? Involved with it, but But I think I've tried to make a bit of a distance between. Right. I don't know. Yeah, but it's certainly an influence. It's certainly very interesting. Yeah.
But
yeah.
You don't see yourself working within. You're not. You're sort of attached to the poetry scene, but you're not. Mm. Not part of it particularly.
It's not my focus. No. 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 And I think what for instance with the this Chopin piece, what I find so interesting is how visual it is. It's just words and the repetition of words, but it creates what to me is a sculpture. It really feels like it's. I have a really clear image of a kind of a wheel-shaped sculpture that's spinning round and round and round. And it's such a clear image that I can't imagine anyone listening to it not seeing that image, which, of course, is just my own. But
you did a book, didn't you, called it Ololo? Ololo.
You can pronounce it however. Yes.
Right. Is that?
And actually, that relates to the Keeping Time video as well, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Yeah, But is that? I haven't seen the book, but is that a sort of like when you see the title on the page, it looks a bit like a typewriter poem or something. It's sort of a yeah.
Well, it's there are no words in the book actually. It's what you do. It's a kind of action book. It's bound with a rivet, so actually all the pages spiral out, a bit like a kind of wallpaper sampling book, you know, when it's kind of a long, thin book and it spirals out into a circular sort of sculptural shape. What you do is you insert your pencil into a little... You hold your pencil still in a little hole that's in the middle of the pages, and then you gradually fold all of the pages, and you can pull them out once they're folded open. And all of them fold open in a different way, in different directions, through different zigzaggy kind of cuts and holes and things. Mm. And gradually all the pages have opened out. You've got a circular sculpture around ahead of you and in front of you. And then you lift your pencil off and realise that your pencil hasn't moved at all. So it feels like it's been through all these journeys, through all these kind of, you know, valleys and troughs and things. And it feels like it's moved an awful lot, but actually you lift it up and it's made no movement at all. Right. Which I find, as you can, we've talked about representation and representing things and not representing things, and it feels like Ololo is doing that. Right. Is doing that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. Now we should move on to the film, maybe, which I've looked at. It's an intriguing film. It's like a twin screen film, and it is quite hypnotic. You can't tell if the paper is turning or if the pen is turning or what, but you've got two. Parallel, side-by-side images. Is it a pencil, close-up of a pencil or a pen?
It's a pen, yeah.
It's like a pen, and each one seems to be trying to maintain its position more or less in the middle of the paper whilst this line sort of kind of goes away from the centre of the pen. It works very well as a twin screen thing because there is this interconnection between. Yeah. Can you describe a bit about the process of that?
Yes, it's a difficult film to describe visually actually because people watch it and they can't quite understand what's going how it's been made as well. No. So it's what you're looking at is the underside of the tip of a pen. Right. You're looking through a sheet of glass and then through a sheet of paper. So you're looking up to the underneath of the pen. And the pen, well, the pen nibs are drawing, but the camera stays lined up with the pen. So the dot of the pen is always in the middle of the screen.
Yeah.
And what it looks like, lines are kind of spiralling out of the centre of the screen.
The camera isn't fixed, is it?
The camera's fixed to the pen with a clamp, you see. So when you move the pen, you move the camera.
Oh, right.
And that's how the nib is always in the centre of the frame, you see.
Right.
So you have this very snake-like kind of scribbling, as if the lines are kind of erupting out of this central point.
Yeah.
When actually what you're looking at is a very normal process of kind of an acemic, you know, sort of abstract scribbly writing, drawing, dancing kind of thing that the pen's doing. But it does look quite arresting because it's difficult to see what's going on.
Yes, exactly.
And it's actually that was commissioned by Modern Art Oxford in 2012, and Olla Lolla, the book, was commissioned by them afterwards as a sort of partner to the video. And really, I wanted to create a similar effect in the book, so the pen, just as the pencil was staying still all the time, Olla Lolla was doing all that movement, like was in Keeping Time, this twin video piece.
Right.
The pen is staying exactly still in the middle of the screen, you see, and all the lines moving around it.
Nico, anything to... We're going to play the track of this, aren't we? Keeping Time at the end, but we'll go out with that, or... perhaps we should... I mean, should we talk briefly about... well, the context, the gallery context. I think that was another topic sort of covered in one of these interviews. You must be able to jump in on that one. That's the context is all or not with these things. I mean, there's something where you say you did something in the home, I think, and that doesn't. And the context of that somehow changes the work.
Very much, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the work in the SE8 exhibition at the moment has a very sort of DIY aesthetic. It's very much the stuff that was available right there.
Right.
So,
there
are cups. Disposable plastic cups that were the cups that the studio has, you know, by their water fountain.
Yeah.
There are funnels that were the easiest I could find, you know, the glass tubes which I found in an old studio space, a board that was actually from a life drawing class which I must return at the end of the exhibition. various, you know, so I think that...
Is it part of your philosophy then that it shouldn't be... expensive or grand you like this do-it-yourself
it's that it shouldn't be made. I think I've made things in the past. I've got part of the way through the process of making things and felt that it felt rather it just didn't feel right for the process for the work. I think I'm interested in sort of generics and things that are just found really. Nico's jumping in,
guess,
and I'm quite glad.
I mean, I guess each exhibition space or gallery or museum has its paraphernalia. We all have the accoutrements of exhibition, and these range from very tiny things, which might be marker pens, all the way up to, I don't know, plasma screens, big projectors and what have you. And I think these are the things that keep getting reused time and time again. And as a small experimental space, of course, we've accumulated a lot of material over time, which is the material that has also shown countless other artists' works. And there is something kind of serendipitous in the reuse of these materials. And we were very pleased the way that Tamarin straight away from the off said, actually, I want to use that and that. And do you have something that's a bit like this? Oh, I really like that. I like the brown on that.
Right.
And so, in a sense, the show was not constructed directly, but it is a kind of happenstance as much as a construction.
So there's a certain degree of improvisation about it?
Very much, a matter of taking what's closest to hand and making do with it, really, I think, because it's not so much the specifics of the object, but what the objects maybe stand for. You know, this will do as a funnel, this does the work of a funnel, this does the work of a piece of paper, this does the work of suspending it from the ceiling, you know, things like that. So using materials that were found in the gallery were absolutely appropriate because it meant that the... there was a kind of inevitability to it that felt appropriate.
Right. Shall we play this track?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Then that would still give us a couple of minutes at the end, because you want to talk about your next show, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, let's just. So this is Keeping Time.
And this is just the audio, and this is, of course, should be seen as a video. So I'm quite interested to imagine it rather like Henri Chopin's piece, okay. Which creates. I'd be interested to know what it sounds like if you haven't seen the video. It's about a minute long.
So that was Keeping Time, the soundtrack to Keeping Time, your twin screen video.
That's right.
Does it work on a loop, or is it just you assemble an audience, so you have to sit there?
Well, the twin screen version was made for the Arnolfini. They wanted to show on two screens, on a single screen. But actually, at Modern Art Oxford, where it was created and installed, it was very large on two separate projectors facing each other. So you'd stand in between the two screens.
Oh, really? Mm. Oh, okay. Oh, so you have to keep looking from left to right.
Yeah, you're kind of trapped
right.
In, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, close together.
Because it's on your website, as literally you can see
That's
both
right.
screens side by side, can't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have a website, which is tamarinnorwood.co.uk, where there's a whole CV, interviews, a blog you do.
I do regularly just write bits and pieces about what I'm doing.
Yeah, which is quite... we haven't got time to talk about that, but that's quite an important part of your work,
yeah, it
isn't
means
it,
that
the blog?
I'm not just showing the finished things on the website, but the workings, which feels very much part of the project.
Well, thank you both for coming in. It's Tamarin Norwood and Nico Oliveira. Tamarin's show is at the SE8 Gallery until...
the 31st of October.
Right, and it's mostly only open Fridays and Saturdays?
Fridays and Saturdays, 2 to 6, although this weekend it's on 12 to 6, including Sunday.
Including Sunday because of this event
that's
going on
weekend.
In Deptford.
Yeah.
Nico, do you want to quickly talk about your next...
Just super quick. Our next show is a Berlin-based artist called David Allen, which opens on the 12th of November. And he actually spent the summer in the gallery space, kind of doing a private residency, in a sense, spending time with the building and thus completely changing his mind about what he was going to do initially. It was going to be an enormous structure that he was going to build laboriously outside. Instead, he's completely revised it, which is very much the nature of residency programs. And he will be working with a series of videos and a series of sounds in the space. And we're very much looking forward to that.
What's his name again?
He's called David Allen.
David Allen. Okay, and that will be at the SE8 Gallery. That's coming up after Tamarin's show.
From the 12th of November.
Yeah. Okay. we don't have another track to play out with, really. Should we play a bit of Sonata?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, yeah. We'll finish up with Sonata 1. You could say briefly what
this is John Cage's Sonata for Prepared Piano.
Fantastic.
It's about preparing things in advance, then playing them.
Perfect.